Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s, and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I'll meet a new guest who tells me about something they've experienced which changed their life forever. Today I'm speaking to John Battle, a former government minister, MP, and a trustee of CSAN, the Caritas Social Action Network. John continues working in the community in Leeds. Just a heads up that this conversation was recorded remotely, so it might sound a bit different, but still is a great conversation. I learnt a lot about John's heart for social justice in this conversation. But who is John Battle?
I grew up in what might be called the traditional second, almost third generation Irish working class family in a place called Ballycar in Dewsbury. And Leeds was the big smoke to me, the city where, till I was nine, I thought the Queen lived. And I actually, at 11, went to a seminary to train to be a priest. And I was there from 11 till senior seminary, 21. And then I transferred from that college to a seminary in the Liverpool Diocese, where I remained till I was 18. And I stepped back. I didn't go forward to be ordained. And strangely, that was fantastic training, for which I'm eternally grateful, really. And part of the work was to be active in the community. You were asked the first question when I was in a class of seven with joiners, accountants. I was the youngest. And in the first week when we arrived at the senior seminary, they said, why do you want to be a priest? Who do you want to serve? And some replied, I want to serve old people. So they said, well, we'll find you a placement in an older person's home. One person said he wanted to work in a hospital. We'll find you a place in a hospital. One person said schools to teach children Catholic education. And I stupidly said, I want to do something about bad housing. So they said to me, right, we've just the place for you, Kirby Estate, the biggest, most intense council estate in Western Europe that they'd built off the edge of Liverpool. Go there for 2 days a week. And I did. And I had to go to that estate. I stayed at the parish and then I went back to the seminary. And we reflected on the action and the work we did. And we studied, yes, scripture, philosophy, liturgy, pastoral studies, ethics. And it was a kind of a good dynamic, if you like, a reiteration between the community action and the reflection. And of course, we then had Mass and the Psalms in the morning, the prayer and the rest of it as part of it. It was a monastic kind of life, but with this blend of action. And there was a wonderful book by a man called Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, called Contemplation in a World of Action. And that, in a way, was the kind of the guidebook. How do you have contemplation in a world of action? Great, great people that I was training with there. I left, I think, because I was getting a bit burnt out by the action of the people. We were organizing bums and tots groups and tenants groups and tackling the council. And I thought I needed a bit of quiet. So I said, I need a break. And I actually went to try my vocation at a Trappist monastery, but John Battle couldn't keep his mouth shut, as the monks realized within about 3 days. So that didn't last very long. And they quickly passed me out into the world and said, I've been institutionalized and could I go and reflect on other things to do, which was brilliant. So I went back to Leeds and went late to university. And as a result of being at university, I was studying literature and modern poetry, but at the same time I was involved in housing campaigns in the city, and that took me into politics, really. And I became a councillor at a very young age. Then I was asked to stand to Parliament. Again, against all expectations, I got elected both times. And then from 87 till 2010, had the privilege of serving as the MP for the neighbourhood where I live now. And I retired in 2010, and I still work in the community, actually, as my day job.
So what did seminary end up teaching you about yourself?
Wow. To some extent, there was a strong, if I look back now, it was about a resilient independence. It was not about working in community, and that is a flaw. Do you know, when I look back on it, we were not taught really, apart from the sport, it wasn't really teaching you to do teamwork. And I think that's a flaw in the whole system, especially now. And priests at that time would go out and be curates for 20 years and a parish priest when they were 60, because you had two or three in a parish in a big house. Whereas now there aren't the priests, and each priest goes out alone into the world and has to survive. And in a way, it was taught that kind of monastic, almost not Cistercian, but Carthusian cell resilience, you know. And there was that in it. So you knew how to try and, live on your own resources, live by books and reading a bit more. But I think the downside was that you were not really practicing the practice of teamwork and working with others in a way that perhaps parishes. One of my great friends tragically died too young, a priest who was in Kirby. He lived in the attic room, the top of the presbytery, while the rest of the presbytery used his house as the community centre. He was a brilliant and open to the community priest. And he developed that model for himself in that context with the people. And the best do that. But it's not really built into the training. The other thing is to try and hold together prayer and action. And that is a massive one. And it relates to those questions of faith and politics and everything else. Is your prayer just private? How public is it? How often do you press the pause button? And regular habits of prayer and liturgy, as in contrast to the massive demands of meetings every hour, which I had when I was a government minister, for example. And I had a wonderful witness. When I was a councillor, there was a Conservative councillor on the opposite side of the council chamber to me. He said the office morning, noon and evening, and sometimes in the mornings at lunchtime I would join in. And he was such a witness that he would fit in the rhythm of the Psalms into the daily life of a counsellor. A wonderful, wonderful witness and one of my great mentors. Though if I turned around and said to people, one of my great mentors was the great Patrick Crotty, who was a top legal solicitor and a top Tory in Leeds. People would perhaps look askance, but he brought it together really well. And there are people like that in our world that we should look to.
So what made you decide to leave seminary?
I'm not quite sure. I think it was, I felt the rush of things coming quickly. I mean, I'd done 3 years, nearly 4 years, and that was when the big decisions had to be made to become a deacon. Don't forget then it was for a celibate life, a life of poverty and a life of service. But I think at the time, ironically, I wanted a quieter life because I'd been doing all these meetings with the people, community meetings, council meetings. I think I felt a bit burnt out by the people, if I'm honest, and wanted to calm down and just reflect and think. So I stepped back. And then ironically, I stepped back and it was with a view to going and trying the monastic life. But I came away a bit lost, really, if I'm deadly honest. I had to tell my family I hadn't got a job, I hadn't got a degree, I was 21, what would you do? And so I had to pick up whatever jobs I could. And then someone suggested to me that I try and get myself into university and do a bit of studying to get a bit of calm and quiet. And someone told me that I didn't need to go to courses, you can just sit in a library if that's what you want to do. And that's what I did want to do. But in fact, the course was worth it. And I got stuck into the community action again. So by that time, things had really moved on, you know.
Yeah. So what did draw you to that life of public service?
I think burning away at me all the time was this sense of injustice that people lived in conditions that they did not deserve and had not made. It was not of their making that they were in bad houses. There were rats and the windows were broken and the kids were all getting coughing and chest complaints and all the rest of it. And then the families rowing and splitting up because of it. And I thought that something needed to be done about the structural conditions. And I was always thinking that poverty was about causes as well as individual actions. There were structures that weren't right, and that we should challenge them, and that if people organised together and talked about them and built relationality, A, they could support each other in working for change, which is important, not having it done to or for them, but at the same time, they could put pressure on. So take on power and challenge it and don't let them ride over you. And there was a strong feeling of that, I suppose, the injustice, really, that needed to be challenged. And you needed, yes, the poor need their own voice, but there also needs to be some voice for the voiceless. And I was a talker.
You are saying being a voice for the voiceless reminds me of Oscar Romero and him standing up for the injustice in his communities. Obviously, that his experience is different to yours, but how did you end up being an MP?
Oh, let me just say, Oscar Romero, the quote's on my wall. I can almost turn the phone to show you. And he said, what's the point of the church? And he said, tell the truth about reality and accompany the people. And those two watchwords, tell the truth, what's really going on. Don't make it up or just get it a story that fits everybody, but also accompany the people. I thought they were brilliant messages for politics as well as for the church. So in a way, I got into politics by, I suppose, making a bit of too much noise in Leeds because I was campaigning against housing conditions while I was at the university, and it appeared in the papers. And I think the Labour Party at that time in Leeds, it was run, the city was a divided city and dividing. It was rich and poor. It always has been. So Conservatives sometimes, Labour sometimes, you know, it echoed from one to the other, if you like. And at the time I was at university, it was Conservative, but the Labour lot were incredibly, I caricature them badly and wrongly as old men with pork pie hats on who were Labour people who really sat in the Labour clubs drinking away and had given up on championing the people. And so I'm making a noise and I got invited into a meeting that was about 200 people, with mainly men who were the leaders of the Labour Party in Leeds. And they asked me to speak about why I was creating such a fuss about bad housing. And as a result of that, I was asked to get involved in the Labour campaigns. I mean, I've been a member, I think, of the Labour Party at the university. But it was really because my father and mother were Labour supporters, if you like. My dad was an electrician and a trade unionist. So the theme of the Labour Party wasn't uncommon in our family. And they asked me to stand for the council in an area that they said you'd never win anyway, but if you make enough noise, it'll distract people, so keep them off other areas. But I actually won and got elected. And then the same happened with Parliament in 87, to my shock and surprise. So as I watched the votes pile up in the town, I turned to Mary, my wife, because we had small children at the time, said, oh my God, it looks like I'm going to go and win. So I said to her, what do I do next? And I think she said to me, I think you're going to London, you fool. And it had never really occurred to me that my life was going to change in a big way, but it did. And wonderfully, the people, wonderful people in West Leeds continued to re-elect me as their MP until 2010.
I was just thinking when you said about having three small children and suddenly realising you're an MP, how do you balance family life and like political life?
Badly is the honest answer, and probably Mary's is the balance because she practically was a single parent while I went to sort out the problems of the world, you know, if the honest truth over history be told. And she looked after bringing up. I came home every weekend. I still lived in Leeds. I never moved to London. And so put in what I could. But in a way, the caricature is true. And there was a cartoon once, an Irish cartoon, had a woman pushing a vacuum cleaner and a child under her arm, and a babe under her arm, and another child pulling at her skirt saying, Mummy, Mummy, where is Daddy? And Mummy replies, I don't know, dear, he's probably out somewhere fighting on behalf of oppressed peoples. It's a cartoon that haunts me, frankly.
Well, that's obviously a challenge for you, but what were some of the joys of being an MP?
The people, without a doubt, the people. When I had a bad time in London, you know, you can imagine, you go to the Parliamentary Labour Party and have an argument about the minimum wage, which I did, and you don't get any support, and you think you're wasting your time down there, and you wonder why you're there. I used to come home and just go round the houses and go round, say, the Waddles and knock on the door on a Friday and just say, look, I'm your MP. It's not election time, but I've just come to see if you're all right, because I'm not really. How are you doing? And the response of the people was fantastic. You know, the support of the people and struggling, but the resilience and their capacity to help serve and work with others is such an inspiration. And that's where Romero's thing is so strong. Accompany the people doesn't mean you doing good for them. It means them saving you.
That is a really challenging thought for anyone who does anything for social action related, because quite often people feel like they're doing it to benefit others, but actually you're being benefited from it.
Oh, absolutely, Julia. When I left Parliament, there was an area near, right on the edge of the constituency, but right in the heart of Leeds, near Army Prison, and there's a big gyratory, and there's an estate there that was, imagine that they drew a map, a boundary map around it, and put it in Hilary Benn's central Leeds constituency, miles away. And so the people were cut off, and Hilary didn't go there, the councillors didn't go there, they felt, and the Harmley, my side, didn't go to see them either. So these people were really unrepresentative. Four massive tower blocks, and in them were men, single men, among others. And some had been tipped out of the prison when released. It had the highest suicide rate in the country in the last few years that I was an MP. So I went in there with a a friend of mine who was a community worker, and we dragged them out and we said, come to a tin hut of a community centre and we'll give you a free cup of tea, a coffee and a big bacon sandwich on a Friday morning. And we met twice with about 8 or 10 men. And it was a lovely daylight, sunny day these days of July. And I said, well, why don't we go for a walk? Because I'm not a therapist. Let's go for a walk out on the canal. And one of them said, where's the canal? And it's about a quarter of a mile away. Beautiful swathe of green, as Patrick Kavanagh might say, the poet, that flows through Leeds. So we started the walking group for men. And then we got money from the health clinic to say, don't give them tablets for depression. Give us money to feed them. So we have a walking group. We meet, we walk, we stop in a coffee shop, then we come back and we share a meal. And we do it every Friday. And we get between, I would say, between 10 and 25 men every Friday. And that's been going now for 15 years. And I kind of lead that group in a way, internal, most. Now, I've only missed about a handful of the sessions. But I would say that group's for me, not for them. I need them more than they need me. I really do. And it was quite funny where, to turn up and to listen to their stories and what they're up against and their challenges and their questions to me and their treatment of me as an equal, it is quite wonderful, really. And yet they would come from walks of life with all kinds of challenges, you know, drug, alcohol problems, been in prison. And we went to a visit to one of the university centres in Leeds, for the Leeds Trinity Catholic University. And what happened was that we were going around the room to say who we were, and one of the men who'd come for the first time, and we didn't normally open up in a formal way like you're asking me questions, just let it go. And just, if you sit down for a coffee in fours, you have to talk to her, you can sit in silence if you want, but people learn to know each other. And one man had been twice, and he turned around and said, and what do you do? And he said, oh, well, actually, I'm a neurosurgeon that had a breakdown. And you kind of thought, so the range of people, and what I learned from that is, mix up the wrong people. You don't know who you are talking to and what their background is most of the time. But the more that you learn about a person, there was a lovely remark that one of the lads made. He said, what we need, John, you're all right about saying hello to people, but what we really need is consistent care. And how does that apply to everybody? You know, and just wonderful insights come out of that group that keep me going. So I need that Friday group more than they need me.
Oh, I feel like we all need that sense of community as well. And you built that community together with those men, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
So my big question that I want to ask and get into with you is, how do faith and politics fit together?
I think it's about values and about the big picture. And I think my mother, when we were children, used to, you know, this is in the age of black and white telly when there are only two channels, you know. So, but what she used to do was get us to sit around the table and cooperate in making jigsaws. So you get a jigsaw and you would try and find the corners and then the blue sky and the green grass and the edges, and you'd have a go at it. And now the only problem was it was a heck of a job. Because she got the jigsaws from different places, which we now know as recycle and second-hand shops. And if they'd put the wrong lid on the box, you had no chance. So the whole thing is, you might have the pieces, but you need a box lid. And it's, what is the box lid? What's the overview? What's the big picture of your worldview, if you like? And that does refer to your politics, your relationships, your spirituality, and your values. And it's how we keep that, we negotiate that big picture all the time and keep that in the forefront. And I think that means that if you think, well, I'm too busy to ever bother thinking about faith and prayer. No, I mean, sometimes you might, you know, I would quite often, especially as a minister, I was terrified as a minister of some of the decisions I had to make. And I'm thinking of the decision, you know, I have some sympathy with the ministers that had to make those decisions about the Afghanis. And I'd been shouting at them because I thought the Afghanis were on a fast track, and I'd been giving talks about the fast track. There were only two. There was one for the, well, there were three, one for the Ukrainians, one for the Afghanis, one for the, then the Syrians were allowed in, and then maybe for the Hong Kong. And I kept thinking, I thought the fast track was there for those people that helped the armed services in Afghanistan. But then I've now discovered they weren't coming because they blocked it and it didn't work. And yet at the same time, and so the carry on over that, as it were, the fact that they weren't brought, and then the leaking, that the job was stopped and da-da-da. And the minister's trying to make decisions, and some of them saying, well, if we told everybody we'd leaked them, everybody's in danger. I have a little bit of a feeling for the ministers having to make those difficult decisions at that time. Even though, and the reason is, I would literally go sometimes and still into a room to give a great speech, or not a great a speech to a great audience. And I would perhaps say a little prayer for the Holy Spirit, but it's not me that's going to speak all this lot, is it? Can you help me out? You know, and I think that is really important, and that applies to voting and speaking. And I think it is politicians use their voice, and it is refining that voice to go back to Romero, tell the truth about reality, but we have to work at the truth. It's not spread on our eyeballs and immediately evident, you know. So working at the truth is a responsible, serious religious duty, really. And it does mean, and also it links to that great word in the Jesuit tradition of discernment, and that is the difficult word. What does it mean? You don't discern it on your own. You discern it by getting other people to check you out. Not least my wife, you know, really. Mary will tell me, much, much, much more political than me. So if you need people that you would have faith in to check you, challenge you, and change you.
I think everyone needs that, but particularly, as you said, people working in politics. What would you say to people who were considering they wanted to be a councillor or an MP or some sort of public service? What would you say to them now?
Go for it. But go for it at the lowest level. I'm massively keen. I encourage people that come to me and say, John, I want to go into politics. So stand for the council. Start at the local level. Make the local more important than the national. And I think we need to tip the whole system up, give the power and the budgets back to the local. It's happening a bit, but it's a bit still a bit top down with the mayors and things like that. But also, I'm a massive fan of the citizens movement. And it was Cardinal Hume who really pushed citizens in London with Telco. And the Catholics, and I'm thinking of Bernadette Farrell and people who really developed citizens, and Seb now in citizens, you know, great witnesses that see the value in relationality, which, you know, the old Pope Francis booklet, Fratelli Tutti, fits perfect template for citizens. And it's probably read by people who are not Catholics involved in citizens more than Catholics now. But that notion of building up power from the base, doing one-to-one conversations that are respectful and not just chat, to learn a bit more deeply about each other and what motivates us and what our values are, building up from the locals. So I want people to say, you know, I once did work training counsellors, and I would say, okay, do you need to know about the history of the Labour Party in Keir Hardie? So, no, we'll do the practical. So I'll take them to the shopping centre in Bramley and say, right, what I want you to do is cross the road and say hello to someone you've never met. Can you do that? And you wouldn't believe how hard it is for someone to go up to someone they've never said, hello, you know, I'm so-and-so, I want to be your councillor, I'm so-and-so, how are you? And some said, oh, and you would get people to say, well, I don't really like people, but I like the theory, you know. And what you have to do is to try to say, this is a practical task of breaking down barriers between people. And that means gently introducing people. So it's an introductions business, building relationality. And citizens with their methodology of one-to-one conversations, then widening them again, getting people together in groups, checking people again, and then challenging power in a way that isn't just shouting and banner waving at people, but engaging to build relations with people in power, I think is the way of building it from the bottom up and bringing about real change. So I would encourage people who want to go into politics to A, get involved in the citizens movement, because they are training the new leaders. And it does not mean everybody joins the Labour Party and that's the only way through. There's a range of options, and newer parties will emerge as we've seen day by day. And we need to rethink what all parties are doing.
On that note, what do you say to people who feel a bit disheartened by when they look at the political system at the moment?
The men are the worst, because the men can't deal with complexity. Women can. The women are the one. What's the expression of a handling 10 things at the same time, multitasking, you know, looking after the children, feeding the men, making sure they don't starve, getting the kids to school, making sure everyone's got clothes and washing done. And so I'm massively in favour of rebalancing the gender balance. In Leeds, wonderfully, we've more women councillors running the council than men. And it's a much calmer city under great challenges than it was when I was a councillor. It's not a ranting shop and it's not a great row in the paper every night. And people in Leeds, despite the challenges in their field, calmer. Whereas at the national level, despite the fact that for the first time we've a lot of women in the cabinet, that's not working through. And there's something to do with the style of the politics that's going on. And I'm not sure, and I know that it's completely marred by social media as a new element, and I'm not sure I would cope with in politics now. So it makes it more difficult. It's faster and it's very complex. But it's also to encourage people to say, oh, people can deal with complexity and complex problems and find ways through them. And I think that is a patience that's getting lost really in politics, and we need people. It's part of that consistent care, isn't it? Being there and having a vision for the medium and long term, not the immediate answer. So I would encourage people, young people and older people, to go into politics. But I'm always saying to them, don't go to be an MP because you'll waste your time at the present time. Go to the local authority and become a leader in your local neighbourhood and change the world from the bottom up.
So looking back, what do you wish you knew about how faith and public service could work together?
How faith and public service could work together. I think I would say that I am disappointed within the church, and that's where organisations like yourself, the Jesuit Faith, and CTAM, Justice and Peace Commissions, but also the Catholic Cares and the organisations in the front line need more support from the thinking and practice of the church in terms of community and engagement. And it's not really there. There is always this fear of politics and the withdrawal system in the church. So not knowing quite how to handle it. And so that means that politicians go to church and feel isolated. And that rocks up in terms of, you know, an MP turns up, goes to mass, four benches from the back, and then the priest tells him to go away, you know, because he hadn't voted right, or has he asked about abortion this week? That isn't the way to build the relationship between faith and politics. So I think, as well as politics, needs a lot of renewal and resetting. And it was Pope Benedict that said it. Pope Benedict's the best on all this, actually. I know we went to the great spiritual witness, the charismatic witness of Pope Francis, but we flashed through the popes and their letters too quickly. And everyone was saying, oh, Benedict, he was radical, then he became a Rottweiler. I don't believe that, actually. I think in some of those encyclicals of Benedict are the key thoughts for developing a proper relationship between faith and politics, but also for transforming the politics. There is some real deep wisdom in there that we ought to let out.
And finally, what are you most grateful for?
Probably the support of Mary. I wouldn't be here if she didn't feed me. Very practical. But no, I think I've had the. I'm grateful. What's it? Praise and thanks. Hallelujah means praise and thanks. I'm very grateful for a journey that is, in a way, very privileged and unique, that's led me into, and it's a privilege to be able to say to young people that I didn't have a back of an envelope like Mike Lesseltine, I'm going to be a councillor, then an MP, then a government minister. I didn't have a track thinking I would ever get that into those positions, that I would be in the office of state at the Foreign Office or anything like that. And I've had a fantastic privilege to meet people as a result of that and learn things from it. So it's been a lifelong learning journey for which I'm very grateful, and hasn't hopefully ended yet.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know what challenged me is John's passion for making a difference to people's lives, no matter what role he takes on. How about you? We'd love to hear how John's story resonated with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. You can find out more about this theme and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time on Things I Wish I Knew.